So today is the fourth, right? Fourth talk in a series on the five precepts. And the first talk was introduction to them all. So I've given an introductory talk, and then I've given a talk on the first and second precept, and today we'll talk about the third precept. And the first three precepts have to do with behavior, with action. And so the first one has to do with not causing harm, not killing. The second has to do with not taking what is not given. And the third has to do with sexual misconduct. So today, we're going to talk about sex. What do you think of that? So the first three have to do with actions we do. The next week has to do with our speech. And the last week has to do with intoxication. So the background for the precepts is that there's much to be said about its background or the theory behind them. But there's two primary things to be said about the precepts. One is that they represent virtues that are the natural expressions of the good heart. When the heart is relaxed, at peace with itself, and then it's said when the heart is free, that there are these virtues that come out of that heart. And the virtues of compassion and not harming, the virtue of generosity and not stealing, the virtues of contentment or loving kindness and not engaging in sexual misconduct are all things that come out of that free heart or the settled heart. The other aspect of the precepts is that they're seen as training precepts. And as training precepts, they're things that Buddhist practitioners will take on because they help to train us. They have a great value in helping us to see ourselves, understand ourselves better in areas that are very important in our lives. As training precepts, they're not really understood as being moralistic. It's just that it's really powerful to practice with the precepts because it's usually the tendency is when we want to break the so-called precepts, when we cross that line over the precepts, it's usually because something has caught in the grip of our hearts. We're driven, there's compulsion, there's grasping, there's attachment, there's deep fear. There's something very deep which kind of has grasped our heart, closed over our heart. And the very movement of Buddhism is to understand those things which contract our heart or close our heart or imprison our heart so we can set the heart free. So it's wonderful. The encouragement of the precept is to look at some of these powerful forces in our life that tend to cause our hearts to somehow not be free. So the training precepts, they're like mirrors. Look at that. Stop and look. So the third precept has to do with our sexuality. And the word is Pali is Kamesu Micha Chara. Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. For the sake of training, I undertake the training precept of not engaging in sexual misconduct. Kama, which is the word here for sexuality, also has the meaning of lust. It also has the meaning of sensual pleasure in general. So the idea is no sensual misconduct. But generally that's understood to be sexual, no sexual misconduct. And so then it begs the question, what is sexual misconduct? And many of us are familiar with societies and cultures and religions that had very strict rules about the definitions of what sexual misconduct is. And probably a fair number of you at various points have rebelled or been critical of particularly sexual norms that maybe you grew up with from your family or your society or something, or you found that the social, some of the common social understandings around sexuality were extremely painful for who you are. And so the question, as soon as we talk about sexual misconduct, some people get nervous because, oh, here's another religion that's going to tell me what I can't do. And I've had that happen before, and that has caused me a lot of pain. The usual way in the ancient tradition in the discussion about sexual misconduct is to define who you can and cannot engage in sexual activity with if you're a layperson. If you're a monastic, there's also a definition of who you cannot engage in sexual conduct with, and that is anybody. You're supposed to be celibate. And for monks, there's all these very graphic explanations of how, anyway. every kind of sexual activity is ruled out for a monk or a nun. And sometimes the tendency is for people to extrapolate from that and assume that that's because sexual activity is bad or wrong, or the ideal is not to engage in sexual activity. Lay people, some of the people choose to live a celibate life and find it very rewarding to do that, find it quite a wonderful way of living. Some people have not chosen to be celibate but are kind of living that way and wish it was otherwise. Some people take on temporary celibacy as lay people. One of the wonderful places to do that is on retreat. In Vipassana retreats, they're celibate environments. When you go on a spirit rock for a retreat, you're expected to be celibate for that time you're there. We don't advertise that. Come to Spirit Rock, 10 days of celibacy. But that's the expectation is you live by the five precepts, and the five precepts on retreat, sexual misconduct is defined there, or how it's worded there, it's worded differently. It's worded commitment to the to brahmacharya, not engaged in any abrahmacharya, non-brahma activity. Brahma activity is can be translated into English as the holy life. It's understood to be celibacy, so doing nothing that breaks the vow of celibacy. And for some people on retreat, it's very interesting because maybe they never had any that kind of limitation on sexuality before. And so it forces them to look at their drives and their thoughts, their mind, their fantasies, a lot of different activities around the world of sexuality. And it gets pretty interesting inside the mind. Even if you're not engaged in sexual activity with some other person actively, there's a lot of sexuality that goes on retreats. I can tell you, people tell me, they come into interview sometimes and let me know the fantasies, the fantasy world that people have. It's just phenomenal. People. So some people are really amazed. They sit down to meditate and their mind is just consumed with sexual fantasies. And it's kind of a burden to them, and they didn't realize what a burden it is until they can't get themselves free of it because just it's always there. So it's interesting to look at that and try to settle that. How to bring that to some kind of peace, how to settle that so there can be some peace, the heart can be free and not driven or caught by that kind of mental activity. For lay people who are not on retreat or haven't chosen to be celibate or engage in a sexual life, again, the tradition then has definitions of who you can cannot engage in sexual activity with. But I don't think those lists are very helpful. In some ways they're helpful. Basically the idea is you don't engage in sexual activity. The classic definition, as I remember it, is you don't engage in sexual activity with anybody who is either in a committed relationship with someone else, like a marriage, or is under the guardianship of someone. So like a young child is under the guardianship of a parent or an adult. Or I guess in the ancient world there were some women who might be adults we're still considered under the guardianship of some adult, some male. And so as long as someone is either in a committed relationship or in the, under the guardianship of someone, then you weren't supposed to involve sexual activity. Here in the modern West, most teachers and Buddhists that I know who try to talk about this precept of no sexual misconduct will define sexual misconduct as not causing harm through our sexuality. And then it becomes a responsibility for each of us to apply that principle in our activity. Are we causing harm in this by this kind of sexual activity? So if there's a committed relationship and we are involved sexually with someone outside that commitment, then that could cause a lot of harm. Someone, various people can feel really deeply hurt. And so, so that would be off limits because it causes harm. And here, I think the underlying principle is that of compassion. We have compassion for people's well-being. We have compassion for people's suffering. And we like to live a life that doesn't cause suffering for anybody. And so, what does it take to do that? Now, sometimes I know there are powerful drives in human beings to engage in sexual activity, sometimes breaking vows of commitment in marriages people have chosen to make. A friend of mine has this little saying. She says, maybe it's common, I haven't heard anybody else say it, but it sounds like a common thing. She says, in relationship to the sexuality, she says, how could something that feels so good be so wrong? Other people heard that little saying? That common thing? I just haven't been around. Yeah, how could something that feels so good be so wrong? So the attraction for sexuality, the attraction to be together with someone in an intimate way, can feel so delicious, so wonderful, so right, so, like star-crossed lovers. And then someone else is in the picture, a third party is in the picture perhaps, who would feel devastated if they found out what happened. And in addition to that, if sexual misconduct of that kind would entail then lying and deceit. And so the question is, what does it feel like in our own spiritual life to engage in lies and deceit? In the theistic religions, there is sometimes the idea that our sexual life is somehow ordained by God in some way. I don't know much about theology, but there's certainly God has strict ideas about who and when and things like that. But you're supposed to procreate, lots of kids. And so there's something sacred about sexuality in that it's kind of this encouragement from God to kind of go out and procreate as much as you can. Buddhism doesn't have a God in that kind of way. There's no kind of admonition or encouragement from God to have kids. And the drive, the sexual drive, the sexual rationale for sexuality would all come from within ourselves. And so we look in ourselves for it rather than some external teachings about it. However, rather than being God-centered, Buddhism to some degree, it's not maybe not karma-centered, but karma is very important. And one of the understandings of karma is that whatever sensual pleasure you have is a result of good karma you've done in the past. So if you have the opportunity in this lifetime to have a really wonderful sexual life, a lot of pleasure, that's said to be the result of good karma in the past. That's nice. Wow, look at that. However, good karma, the karmic equation kind of stuff, for sensual pleasure, comes from having lived a compassionate and generous life. But if you use sensual pleasure in ways that somehow are uncompassionate or ungenerous or involve deceit, then in some ways you wipe out and reverse that good karma. And so later, you'll get born some other way, some terrible way that I don't know, like those spiders that supposedly eat their mate after they so watch out. And so it's kind of a little paradox, you know. You have this wonderful sensual pleasure, illicit sensual pleasure, because of good karma you did in the past, but you're making really bad karma now for the future. That's kind of interesting. But the idea is not to cause harm. And so the question is how to study that, how to understand that. And by having the guideline no harm, then it allows for a wide variety of sexual expressions and activity. As you know, it could be almost infinite as long as no one gets hurt in the process. And so there's some feeling or some idea in Buddhism that Buddhism is somewhat flexible around sexuality according to the conventions of society that Buddhism is in. That societies have conventions, and what causes harm has something to do with those conventions. So rather than harm being some absolute standard, some absolute ideas, it has a lot to do with the agreements we have in particular societies, understandings we have of what it means to be in self, what it means to be self in relationship with other people, things like that. So it's not so unusual in parts of Buddhist Asia, and not so much anymore, but still a little bit in places, that there are marriages with more than one wife or more than one husband, because that's kind of convention that was seen as okay in those kind of cultures. And Buddhism says it's fine as long as no one gets hurt. My impression is that some Buddhist countries in Asia are a little bit permissive about sexuality outside for people who are not married. That, you know, there's, you know, if you're not married, you're not breaking a marriage vow or a commitment vow if you have. And so there's no idea that, you know, you have to be a celibate until, or a virgin before you get married. You know, what you know, as long as no one's getting hurt, as long as, you know, transgressing against someone inappropriately, then you know, there's no, you know, it's not causing harm. It's fine. But the question of causing harm, I think it's can get, it's in some ways a stricter teacher than having a, you know, rule. You know, only sex in marriage, for example. That's, some people have that rule, I think. Only sex in marriage. Everything else is denied. But but the idea of causing no harm, because even within committed relationships, where supposedly, you know, it's okay to have sexual activity, people can cause harm with their sexuality. And sexuality can be used as a weapon. It can be used as a part of the expressions of hostility. And it can be withheld or used certain ways. When I was growing up in Italy, there was a song that became popular, that the refrain went, "Chi non lavora non fa l'amore," and in English it's something like, "He who doesn't work doesn't get to make love." And apparently the unemployment rate in Italy dropped dramatically after that song came out. And all these wives understood they had this, what do you call it, this, you know, some control. And but, you know, certainly there can be, sexuality can be used even inside a committed relationship to cause, that are harmful ways. There can be powerful expectations and pressure connected to sexuality. There can be non-acceptance of each other. There can be criticism. There can be frustrations and anger and all kinds of things that come around people's relationship to each other around their sexuality. And a lot of harm can be caused. The encouragement in Buddhism, Buddhist practice, is certainly not to cause harm, but more than not to cause harm, to actually turn the mirror around and look inside of ourselves and try to find out what are the impulses that are there that were driving the desire to cause harm, the movement to cause harm. What was the sense of discontent? What was the frustration? What was the craving? What was the fear? What was the, you know, all kinds of things that come into play. To understand what those things are, and then to clarify or settle them. That's always the emphasis in the most. Can we settle something? Can we free ourselves from something? Rather than just kind of have a rule. Just to have a rule is maybe kind of dangerous. But to have a rule that's a mirror can be a rule that's a mirror, not a rule that's a barrier. So one of the ideas in this precept of sexual not engaging in sexual misconduct is not to cause harm. And then it becomes our responsibility to apply that and understand what that is. So there isn't some kind of fixed guideline about what it should look like. Sometimes it's quite appropriate in certain relationships to have sexuality outside of marriage, because that's the understanding of the marriage. I've met people who have open marriages, and they seem to be doing just fine. I've met people who said they had open relationships, open marriages, and it seemed really unhealthy to me. And I've seen ones that seem to work just fine. And there's all kinds of different ways that people, conventions and ways in which, you know, people organize themselves and take care of themselves. What's happening here in, you know, California, more than maybe almost anywhere, is that we don't have a homogeneous culture. And we have this amazingly heterogeneous culture with so many different cultures and subcultures and sub-subcultures and sub-sub-sub-subcultures and, you know, it goes on and on. And so that there's so many different understandings of what conventions the people are willing to live by. And so what causes harm has a lot to do with the conventions that people have agreed to live by. The problem is when people have different conventions and haven't talked about them. So I think a lot of healthy sexuality, if it's going to be more creative than some of the more standard ones, is I think that people need to be fairly explicit about what the agreements are, what the understanding is, what the views and conventions are that we're living by. Because if those things are not out on the table to be discussed and be clear, then we can miss each other and cause harm. The other principle, so one of the principles in this thing about not having sexual misconduct is not harming. The other principle has to do with not harming ourselves. The first has to do with not harming someone else. But the second is not harming ourselves. And here the idea is that if we're operating out of greed, if we're operating out of hostility, if we're operating out of power play, if we're operating out of fear, if we're operating out of... There's many things that come into play around sexuality. If we're, then we're probably harming ourselves as well. To be in the grips of greed causes harm to our own hearts, to our own minds. So, to understand, a very important aspect of Buddhist spirituality is to understand how we cause harm to ourselves, and then to find, again, what the causes of that harm is, and how to release ourselves from that, how to free ourselves from that, how to settle something so that that harm is not there. How to live in such a way that... Now, sexuality, our sexual lives, are not simple phenomena. Probably all of you realize that all too well. They're incredibly complex, and especially, all over the world, but here in certainly California, it has to do with relationship, and it has to do with who we are in relationship. And there's a lot of things converge onto sexual relationships that's more than simple sensual pleasure, or more than libido, satisfying libido. There are deep issues of identity, deep issues of feeling connected, of union. And so when we get connected to someone else in the kind of deep way that sexuality can sometimes do, there's a feeling of there's a lot of needs that we're trying to get met. There's a lot of needs that sometimes we're trying to meet through sexual activities. Sometimes people are trying to satisfy needs of power. Sometimes people satisfy needs of shared identity, borrowed identity. We have sexual activity with someone who's powerful or kind or spiritual or this or that way. Somehow we kind of enter into their realm and their world and share with that and kind of feel, kind of become part of that. There can be, some people have strong needs of being dominant, some people have strong needs of being submissive, and sometimes the dominant ones don't find the submissive ones. And so they're not so harmonious, and sometimes they do find each other, still not so helpful. There's so many different things that happen in the sexual relationship that it probably would take a long time for people to tease apart all the psychological needs that we have in those relationships. So the idea of looking at harm and looking at how we harm others and how we harm ourselves enters into a very complex world of psychological relationships that is not so obvious. It's not what seems on the surface to be what's happening. When I was in my early 20s or so, I had begun practicing. And I got very interested in this phenomenon of falling in love. And I was curious to know, I wanted to know how that happened. You know, there's like, I found myself, you know, somebody was attractive, and suddenly I found myself, you know, in love or something, attracted. And so I tried to pay as careful attention as I could to that, as mindful as I could to what was going on. And what I was most curious about was it a choice that I made to fall in love? Or is it just chemistry? Get smitten, you know. And I'm only, you know, a sample of one person, you know, and a few times in my life. But what I found when I paid careful attention, there was a point of choice where I chose to fall in love. I think I'll do this. It usually happens pretty quickly or kind of subtly. But it wasn't just chemistry. They just kind of, you know, something happened. There I was. But it was something, you know, there'd be some pleasure or some various things going on, some various things I'd feel. And then at some point there was a choice. And that choice then set in motion the things that I would call falling in love and being driven, you know, and really having strong desire. But if it enters into the realm of choice, then I think it gets also very interesting. I found it really fascinating then. What's that choice? And what are the choices we make? And how do we make those choices? When do we say yes? When do we say no? How do we cause harm with our sexual energy? I've been to countries in the world where flirting seems to be what people do. You know, and nothing's really meant exactly. It's just what people do. It's really fun. You know, I've been to Brazil, and it was so much fun. and some subcultures here in America also, I've noticed, flirting is really a thing to do. And it's really, I love it when, I don't know, I think it's really nice when gay men flirt with me. I don't know. I've been in San Francisco sometimes, and I remember storekeepers who are gay sometimes start flirting with me, and it doesn't feel like anything's expected or anything's going to happen, or just, you know, it seems really clean to me, and you start flirting, and I think it's just really fun. You know, it seems. But then there's a whole other cultures, subcultures, and where that convention of flirting just makes people so uncomfortable. People tighten up, they get offended, they get all, you know, causes harm. So there are different conventions. And then one of the interesting questions around this whole issue of sexuality is, how do we coexist with people who have different conventions? How do we be sensitive to each other, to different convention ways of understanding how to behave and what sexuality is about? You know, I grew up a little bit in Italy. My sister also, but she spent more time in Italy than I did growing up. She went to high school there, Italian high school, and she found that you know, the custom in Italy, in the high schools there, people form these big cliques called compagnias, and men and girls and boys and high school students would all kind of be together in this big gang, and they'd roam around town and do things together, and you know, they'd be all a bunch of friends together. And so she went to high school for 2 years in Italy with this, having all these male friends where there was nothing sexual at all. She got used to it. And she came back to Los Angeles for the senior year. And if a boy asked her to do anything, like go out for lunch or go do something, and she had to learn very quickly that it wasn't so innocent. And it was really confusing for her and very strange to her that they were all these imitations from the boys were all sexualized, because in Italy they hadn't been. And it was kind of painful for her to have that. So here's, you know, it's causing pain. And I've talked to a number of people who've grown up in foreign countries and come to America, and they've been very confused about sexual activity here, how it's done here in this country. My favorite story of this is, I read many years ago a study of, they did, okay, right after World War II in England. And some sociologists, psychologists had discovered that that English women had this idea that American servicemen were really fast. Like, they just wanted to jump into bed. They're really quick to jump into bed, kind of a little bit promiscuous, I guess. But American servicemen, they had the same idea of the English women. And they're both kind of complaining about each other, I guess, some way. Anyway, so these psychologists or sociologists wanted to study this phenomena. So they studied courting in these two different cultures, England and America. And they found that somehow there were 12 steps between first meeting and intercourse. 12 kind of courting stages. And they both cultures had 12 stages. However, they weren't the same stages or the same sequence. And what they found is was that apparently is that if an English woman starts kissing, or the kissing starts at the stage of, you got into the stage of kissing, it's much more serious for her than it is for the serviceman. So she thinks, I got to make a decision here. Either we jump into bed, or, you know, or I say no. And so she thinks, oh, let's, you know, she jumps into bed. Some of them do, not all of them, of course. But some of them say, well, if I'm going to be serious with this, relationship, I got to take it to the next level. And for her, kissing maybe was, you know, stage 11, but for the serviceman was stage 2. And so they kind of missed each other. They were confused. There was confusion about these, you know, what these different things meant. One of the solutions to a very important solutions or responses to this precept of sexuality is to keep the lines of communications open. To really talk and talk about values, talk about understandings, talk about impulses, talk about intentions, talk about impact, talk about what's really going on. And more honesty there can be in the relationship, the easier it is to understand what does and doesn't cause harm. So that's my encouragement. I don't, you know, what people do, I don't know what people do, but you should at least be upfront and honest and talk about it. If you're not going to talk about it, if you're not going to be honest about it, then watch out. Suzuki Roshi, was once asked by his students in the 60s, during sexual revolution times, about sexuality. And he said that one of the things he said is, I don't understand what you guys are doing with sexuality here in America. Don't talk to me about it. So. But talk to each other. Talk to the people that's, you know, talk. Lots of talking. Each of the 12 stages, talk. When I was living at Tassajara in the early 80s, I was, I didn't call myself celibate. I wasn't thinking about being celibate, but I was asexual, very happy asexual. I wasn't, I thought, oh, I guess that's gone. And after almost 3 years there, this woman showed up. And so there was this attraction, and because I was a ordained at Zen Center as a priest, and Zen Center has a non-celibate ordination, part of my understanding of how to do this was not just simply talk to her about what was going on each step along the way, but also to talk to my Buddhist teachers about it. You know, the guy who had ordained me. And I just wanted to have it really clear, and I wanted to be really conscious of what I was doing. And I felt I needed to kind of be accountable to my teacher about this. And my poor friend who I got involved in, she couldn't believe it. You're talking to other people about us? So that's the deal. You're getting involved with a Zen priest. What do you expect? And then the final thing I'll say is that as I maybe keep saying now, the intention behind these precepts, and especially this one, is that of compassion. And finding out how we can settle our hearts so we can come and live our life from a place of contentment, find out where the contentment resides, and also to find how we can come from loving kindness. And sexual activity that arises out of contentment and loving kindness is the best, is really great, it's really a wonderful way of engaging in sexual activity. When if it doesn't have loving kindness as part of it, kindness and compassion as part of it, it's all too easy for it to have some element of harm that's part of it, I think. So I wasn't sure if I wanted to do questions today. I didn't know if it was safe. But is there one or two questions? If you could, but we're using the, please use the mic here.
Thank you for your talk, Gil. I'm particularly interested in the relationship between clinging and being in love, falling in love, and sexuality. Can you comment on that at all, please?
The relationship between clinging and falling in love and sexuality. Well, I don't know what the relationship is. I think that sometimes there's a strong element of clinging, a strong element of grasping or craving that goes together with a drive for sexuality, drive for sexual connection. And the interesting thing is, in the study, what is it we're craving to? What are we clinging to? And there's a lot of things. There's a whole, range of things that people... It's so complex. The sexual activity is an amazingly complex thing. Physically, maybe it's pretty simple. Psychologically, I think sexual activity is a container for... our whole cultural understandings of what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a human being in relationship to other people. And so there's a whole range of things we can cling to. So for example, I mean, just a small thing. It's been pointed out over, and we've all noticed it. We now have a very sexualized culture. And so the media and advertisement and everywhere, there's kind of sexuality that's being used to sell things. And so sexuality sometimes is held up as being, this is how you're going to fulfill yourself as a human being. Or this is, if you're going to really be a successful human being, you have to have, this really amazing sex. That's what it's about, right? And so the clinging isn't just simply to want to be in, have a sexual relationship, but the idea is to have a particular kind of sexuality. You know, you're measuring it. You know, so there's clinging there too. You know, there's, you know, just infinite, the kind of clinging. Is this helpful at all? I'm just kind of blabbing. What are some of the things? Let's hear from the group here. What are some of the things that, not you, of course, but other people, other people that you kind of, you know, have noticed? What do people cling to, when they fall in love or when they want to be engaged in sexual activity? Can we make a list of possibilities? Are we shy?
Well, one is clinging to the fear of being alone.
Clinging to the fear of being alone. Okay. Thank you. Insecurity. Clinging to security.
Clinging to comfort.
Clinging to comfort.
Clinging to the fear of rejection.
Clinging to the fear of rejection.
Status.
Clinging to status.
Inadequacy.
Clinging to inadequacy.
Being involved in clinging. That's either way, whatever way, but inadequate or inadequate.
So clinging is connected to the whole field of being feeling inadequate and adequate, and so clinging to thinking, well, I'm going to be adequate if I have this relationship, and so we cling to that.
Appearance.
Sorry.
Appearance.
Clinging to appearance. Yes. Clinging to intimacy and connection. Even though intimacy and connection are wonderful things, there can be clinging to it. That's extra.
Reacting to or opposed to family remembrances?
What does that mean?
How you in your family of origin, how people related to one another.
Oh, I see. The clinging has to do with the reactivity to how people related in the family of origin.
Either repulsion or
repulsion
attraction.
Yeah. I'm not going to do it that way.
Yeah.
No way. You know.
May I ask another question?
Please.
Isn't sexual activity a distraction from the deep sadhana, or being very serious in spiritual activities?
Yeah. It certainly can be. So for example, on retreats, when people are on retreat and engage in very deep meditation practice, it would just kind of blow the deep meditation practice out of the water to be involved in sexual activity. Just like, you know, in long silent retreats, You'll be blown out of your meditation practice if you engage in a conversation, if you listen to the news on the television or something. So, because it just changes the energy and dynamics so dramatically. So in certain contexts, I think it's definitely true that sexual activity gets in the way of deep practice. One of the theories in Buddhism around sexuality and enlightenment is that the more enlightened you get, the less sexual drive you have. So that's a pretty good advertisement for Buddhism, right? So would you trade full enlightenment for your sexuality? What do you think, huh? Some of you are nodding yes. And the old ones here. And And but for lay people, there's no expectation that you're supposed to stop your sexual activity, but that perhaps as certain sensitivity, as certain changes and freedoms happen within your own heart, the nature of that sexuality will change over time. And maybe sexual drive will lessen when there's less clinging as part of it. The more clinging there is, the more fear there is, the more, you know, all kinds of extra things to sexuality. Sometimes it keeps it going much more strongly. And when that, a lot of the clinging and attachments relaxes, there can be less, sometimes less sexual activity. And sometimes clinging and attachment work in the opposite direction. They work as inhibitions to sexual energy. And sometimes the more free a person gets, the more their sexuality becomes set free. So that's part of it. The other thing, though, to say is that there has been a tendency in many religions, and Buddhism certainly has done this also, to create a strong divide between sexuality and spirituality. And even though there's no expectation that lay people are supposed to be celibate, there is sometimes a strong divide. And one of the results of that divide is that there's been not enough mindfulness or care given to practicing within the sexual activity itself, within sexual life itself. And I think there's tremendous opportunities in all aspects of our human life for deepening our practice, and that includes our sexual life. And you'll find very few Buddhist teachers who will talk about sexuality as a domain area of practice, and what are some of the issues that come up, and how do we talk about it, how do we work with it. And people tend to be very quiet about this, you know, huge area of human life. And I think that for some people, it's a very important area to explore and deepen and understand what's going on. Yes?
Is it necessary for there to be a physical expression to constitute misconduct, or can the misconduct be in thoughts only?
Well, I think in terms of causing harm, there can be harm can be created in all kinds of ways. I've known people who have felt imposed upon in very uncomfortable ways by the way people someone else looked at them, at a sexual way of looking at them, and they, you know, just made them feel really icky.
So step number 12 is not necessary to constitute misconduct.
If someone, no.
Okay.
Any step along the way can. Last one, yeah.
You talked briefly about the theory that that as you become more enlightened, more fully enlightened, that perhaps the sexuality drops away. Are there understandings by Buddhist teachers that are alternative to that, that there may be a fully enlightened sexuality? And could you talk about that at all? A kind of sexuality that is fully enlightened, that's fully mindful.
I don't know so much about that. In the Theravadan tradition, the basic theory is that as you are more and more freed, there's less and less sexual drive. But you don't have to worry about that, because you have to be pretty well enlightened to have that start happening, you know. You know, and it, you know, if you're getting even close to that, if you're getting even close to that level of enlightenment, you know, your whole view of yourself and the world is going to be radically different than it is now anyway. So maybe, you know. There are other schools of Buddhism where sexuality is much more an explicit part of the path and the practice. So for some of the tantric traditions, for example. And I haven't studied them so much. So I don't know so much what goes on there in those practices. I also don't understand the spiritual path in some of those Buddhist traditions, because I haven't engaged and haven't been on that path, and I don't know all that's involved in it. What I do know is that in some of the schools of Buddhism where sexuality is included as part of the path, there's also a lot of sexual abuse. And I've known people who had the Buddhist teacher say, basically, I'm enlightened, I'm a Buddha, I know what you need, and you need me. So, but that's an area I don't know so much about. So, I hope this has been encouraging for you to bring mindfulness to part of your life that is probably a huge part of everybody's life, whether you're engaged in sexual activity or not. Sexuality for everyone is, for most people, deserves our attention. Thank you.